I often wear something that has to do with the day's subject. And today I have a quite collection of T-shirts. You see, that's really a rat's body, and I'm the head. You get the idea. There's a bunch of cheese here, and I bring this up because when one discusses reverence for life, one likes to exclude some life that we don't like. For example, in one of the nursing homes that didn't have any animals, one of my associates says it'd be great to put gerbils in there. They look like small rats. And it wasn't 24 hours before some of the residents were down there trying to get into the cage to get those rats out so they could stomp on them, because they were from an agrarian population, and that's what they did to rats on the farm. And I'm reminded of when I was a postdoctoral fellowship from National Science Foundation in a medical school. I as a veterinarian was there for further study, and I sat in on lectures by the professors for the students, and they had some laboratories that involved, in one case, we did a lot of measurements because it was human medicine on people, and the students, of course, were very careful in how they handled the people. But then they had a dog experiment where all the dogs had been anesthetized, and then there were some procedures on them. And I was distressed as a veterinarian how they regarded the dogs versus the people that they had been taking blood pressures on and so forth. And when I went to the University of California at Davis, where I was on the faculty of both medicine and veterinary medicine, and I was really pleased at how the veterinary students treated the dogs. It was altogether different because they were their patients, you see. But then we had a rat experiment, and the veterinary students treated the rats like the medical students treated the dogs. Until I finished talking to them, and then they straightened out. But we have this selectivity, don't we? I mean, we choose it. Now, today, I want to discuss with you, as I announced, reverence for life. And it's a name of a course that I've given for now into the eighth year at varying universities, seven times or so, or eight times maybe, at our own university, at Washington State University, but I've also taught it in parts of it at Murdoch University in Western Australia, University of Georgia, University of Tennessee, University of Illinois this April, Pacific Lutheran University. And I'll be teaching at Louisiana State University and then back to Tennessee this next year. And I feel that it is well to address the subject of reverence for life at this time in our history, when in my generation we've become immune really to catastrophic dimension. A killing, even mass genocide, doesn't seem to shake us anymore. In fact, no generation has probably been as wasteful of life and time as the one I am a member of. And I felt that it was time to take killing seriously. Our animals, I felt, must no longer be treated as disposable and throwaway items. And as with probably the life of many of you, I've been influenced a great deal by my readings, both in the Old and New Testament. And in saying this, I must mention that, and as will be revealed as we proceed today, that in many theologians and many religions do not regard animals as significant others. and I think this will become evident to you. I've also been influenced by the Russian authors, such as Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn, and by C.S. Lewis and Paul Tournier. I've talked to Paul Tournier about animals. He said that he often prescribed animals. And when I saw him last, which was in October of 83, he was then 85 years old, and he said he was going to get another dog when he got old. I thought that was kind of neat. Helmut Tillich also had something to say about this, and I'll be quoting from him. He's one of the great preachers of the present age. And then in my own situation, what I did when I started my Reverence for Life, I sought out a scholar in town who was a pastor at the Missouri Synod Church, who was a Hebrew scholar, really, and named Jim Rimbach. He took his PhD at Johns Hopkins University, and he's now a professor in Hong Kong at a seminary. But I brought him in to discuss in the Judeo-Christian ethic the human-animal interrelationship. And he did a really great job of it, and some of what I'm going to tell you is based on some of his research. And in fact, I recommended that he publish this, and it was published in the International Journal. And since that time, he's written now two more articles. In fact, another one has been published in the Journal of the Delta Society. So that was fun. And Roger Pettinger, who's been here at Holden, who just finished his PhD in history, but has been a long-time pastor, campus pastor, who is a Schweitzerian. I brought him to discuss Albert Schweitzer. So they have made an impression on me, and certainly Schweitzer, because that's where I got the word. Now, in my childhood, I was brought up by Norwegian immigrants to this country, and we were taught to revere domestic animals. You didn't mistreat domestic animals. For one thing, it would affect production, of course. Your production in your animals is a function, really, of how you gentle the animals, and this is well documented scientifically. But also to respect the handicapped people and old people. But other creepy crawly things and birds and stuff were fair game. And like a lot of kids, as soon as I was able to pick up a rock, I'd throw it at birds or creepy crawly things. I graduated to a BB gun. Then a 22 short, 22 special, 28 gauge, 410, 28 gauge, and then a 12 gauge shotgun. And then I think my brother got a rifle. Oh, did I take you through a slingshot? No. Slingshot. I graduated from rock to a slingshot. Yeah, got pretty good at a slingshot. And I developed really a very careless disregard for these beautiful animals, these lovely creatures, partially due, I think, to peer pressure, because that's what boys did. A group of us would go out and shoot at pookie birds, just to be doing something. The same thing happened to Albert Schweitzer. Who's if you don't know him, you'll know about him in a few minutes now, whose work I haven't read all his works, but I've read quite a few of them and have admired him for many, many years. It was a great disappointment to me when Time magazine, 1950, had the man of the half century. And I was pulling for Albert Schweitzer, but Winston Churchill got it. But when he was 8 years old, which is about 104 years ago now, grew up in, I think, Alsace-Lorraine or in that area, he, one lovely spring morning before the leaves were on the trees, he was invited by his neighbor, a boy a year older, to go out and shoot birds with their slingshots. And so they did. Somewhat reluctantly, perhaps, on the part of Albert Schweitzer. And he, it was a lovely day, not as warm as today. And they went to the edge of the village, and the neighbor boy leaned over, picked up the right kind of rock. If you know slingshots, you gotta have the right kind of rock. And he signaled Albert to do the same. By this time, they were at a tree, a leafless tree, with a lot of birds singing in it. And so Albert leaned over, picked up a rock, and just as he was pulling back their slingshots to let go, the warning bell for the first church service started ringing. And old Albert, on hearing it, threw down his slingshot and ran for home, and of course scared the birds away. And in recalling this event, Albert Schweitzer said, "And ever afterwards, when the bells of Holy Week ring out amidst the leafless trees in the sunshine, I remember with moving gratitude how they rang into my heart at the time the commandment, 'Thou shalt not kill.'" And years later, he reflected on this. He reflected on this incident, and he realized that that particular day marked a turning point in his life. From that day on, he had the courage to free himself from the fear of men, from his peers. And in this regard, he wrote, "There slowly arose in me the unshakable conviction that we had the right to bring pain and death to another being only in the case of inescapable necessity, and that all of us must feel the horror that lies in thoughtless torturing and killing. This conviction has become increasingly dominant within me. I become more and more certain that at the bottom of our hearts we all think so and simply do not dare to admit it and practice it because we are afraid that others will laugh at us for being sentimental and because we have allowed our better feelings to be blunted. But I vowed that I would never let my feelings get blunted, and I would never again fear the reproach of sentimentalism." He went on to say that whoever is spared personal pain must feel himself called upon to help in diminishing the pain of others. We must carry our share of the misery which lies upon the world. And while still a student, he wrote, "I resolved to devote my life until I was 30 to the office of preacher, to science, and to music. And if by that time I should have done what I'd hoped in science and music, I would take a path of immediate service to my fellow man." And in 1905, he's born in 1875, when he reached the age of 30, he had already earned two doctor's degrees and was certified in a third discipline. He had published three books, and he realized also the desperate need of people in the African Congo for medical help. At the age of 29, he had read a missionary journal from France, about the African Congo. He then decided to essentially give up all he had done, because he was well-schooled in philosophy, music, and he was a preacher. And he then decided to go into medicine, which took 8 years. And he did this so he could help out those victims of disease and also foreign exploitation in Africa. He went to Lambourine in the French part of Africa at that time. And he was concerned because many of these people, of course, had been forced into slavery. And he'd also, in his philosophical readings, had read a good deal of some Asian philosophies. He looked at how the In ancient times, the Chinese and also the Indians regarded animals. And they had a far more enlightened view of animals than his fellow citizens in Europe, which distressed him a great deal. He was very distressed how people overworked their horses and beat them and treated them very badly. And he realized, such as India, the first clinic both for people and animals were developed in India a long, long time ago. So he studied, and he also made some more statements, which I'll tell you about. What is the nature of this degeneration? He was looking at, you know, what was happening to his fellow citizens relative to their regard for life. This is a degeneration in our civilization. And why has it come about? The disastrous feature of our civilization is that it is far more developed materially than spiritually. Its balance is disturbed. Now come the facts to summon us to reflect. They tell us in terribly harsh language that a civilization which develops only on its material side and not in the sphere of the spirit heads for disaster. And after getting to Africa, he arrived there in, I think, 1913. He had married, when he was finishing up in medical school, he married a very fine person. I think she was a scholar in her own right, but she was also trained to be a nurse so she could help in a hospital which they set up in Lamborghini. His first job when he got to Africa, I mean, he took out upon himself. He arrived there and they were unloading their equipment. And there were some people using horses there for drayage, for pulling large wagons. And there was a big load on this cart, and there were two horses there and two people sitting on top of the load. The wagon was stuck, and they were beating the horses. Get going. So his first act in Africa was to get the people off the wagon, get them behind and help him push them out. And he probably remonstrated with them about how they shouldn't beat their horses. But he still was looking, really searching for what would be an expression of his philosophy in this regard. And in his second year there, he was called on a mercy mission down some distance from Lamborghini on the Ogowi River, or however you pronounce it. They didn't go by helicopter then, by a slow river barge to a mission of mercy. And it was on his second day. The boat was going through a bunch of hippopotamuses, kind of winding their way through it, and it suddenly struck him, reverence for life. And he said that the iron door yielded, the path in the thicket had become visible. And after that, he was never the same again. He said, the deeper we look into nature, the more we realize that it is full of life, and the more profoundly we know that all life is a secret, that we are united with all of life that is in nature. Man can no longer live for himself alone. We must realize that all life is valuable and that we are united in all of life. From this knowledge comes our spiritual relationship with the universe. Now, I should also tell you just a little more about him, that he had a lot of animals. He had some cats and he had some pelicans. One of the pelicans was sort of a guard at his door. He had some pigs, very fond of pigs. One of them was a very recalcitrant pig. It got in a lot of trouble and it run all over the place. It was very badly trained. And it would run through and tip over things and eat things it shouldn't. And it finally got so bad he had to send it off to the zoo in England. And it really hurt him to do that. But he did go several years later to visit in the zoo in London. But he had one pet pig that was very good. And whenever he had an outdoor chapel, and whenever the chapel door bell rang, the pig was the first one to the chapel. And he always laid down in the same spot, which was next to where Schweitzer always said. And he had an assortment of other animals because people realized he was a soft touch. And, like if they'd maybe shoot the parent of a of say a monkey, they'd bring in the little ones, or somebody shot the mother goose or something, or the pelican, they'd bring in the little ones, and he'd pay him for it and raise them. He was thought of some kind of a nut because he never really killed anything that didn't have to be killed. Somebody said, "Are you going to talk about his mosquitoes?" You know, I mean, if they weren't a threat to anything, he would not destroy it. Or if he walked along the path and there were ants crawling, he wouldn't stomp lightly. I mean, they were there, and he'd walk over them. When he was constructing, and he helped build the hospitals and everything, and when they dig the foundation, and maybe the next day they were going to start pouring the cement or something, he'd go down there first and see if there were any live animals, frogs or anything that had fallen in there, so he could rescue them before they did it. And also in plants. I mean, you know, you just don't go plotting through. And I'll show you. I'll tell you how this has affected me. But that's the kind of fellow he was. And he had, of course, a difficult time during the wars, because he was considered in the First World War as a really sort of an enemy, because he was a German extraction. And he also spent some time away, I guess, in the Second World War. But for most of his life then, from the age of 38 until he died at 90, he spent most of the time in Lambaree and became internationally recognized. He was given a Nobel Prize, presented a Nobel Prize for Peace in about 1953. So he was a man who most people haven't really fully understood. Because there probably aren't very many people available who can evaluate him in his entire scope. Because there aren't too many people who are a combination of accomplished musicians, physicians, theologians, philosophers, you see, ethicists. There aren't many people that can really assess the whole thing. So and that's one reason a lot of people don't know about him today. They'll pick out one area and then tee off on it, you see, without looking at it in its entirety. He has written a good deal. One of his books is Reverence for Life. Now I shift to another troublesome area. Now we have some Bibles, you got some more there. We're going to look at these in this order, and the first one, I'll read the first one, and then you can be turn to these various ones, and then we'll go through this. And I shift now, because this is a very troublesome area. In Genesis 1:28, it says, "Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. Fill the earth and subdue it." So we have this commission, essentially, of dominion and subduing the earth, you see. And most people stop there. And many of those certainly outside of the church, and some within, say that they blame most of the ecological ills on the Judeo-Christian ethic. That this is where it all started, we're the ones that have ruined things. The reason for going through this is to show you that there's some other scripture and other writings that might not coincide with such a view. Really, we are representatives of a cosmic Lord as stewards, as caretakers of a very great creation. But exercising dominion is a heavy burden with opportunities, of course, for great good and also very great evil. And we can look around and see that. We are told in regards to animals, into your hand they are delivered. So you and I are explicitly responsible for them. We are, and our animals share utter dependence upon God. Mankind is treated throughout as an independent spiritual I, while the animals are not self-conscious of the source of their life, as far as we can tell, although next week I'll be discussing do animals think, or animal consciousness, which is a very interesting subject. There's some question, probably, you know, at least among pygmy chimpanzees. But in God's intention for animals is in large part mediated by the likes of you and me. In this regard, we share responsibility with God. The recognition that our animals are not self-conscious of the source of their gift of life is an added responsibility on all of us. There is, throughout the Old Testament, the added dimension that we and our animals share the same fate, but it is not open to manipulation by the animals, but by us. We are the ones who shape the destiny of the animals and our environment. My friend Jim Rimbach, who I've told you about, who's this Missouri pastor and a Hebrew scholar, said that what people do about their ecology depends upon what they think about themselves in relation to things around them. Human ecology is deeply conditioned by beliefs about our nature and destiny, that is, by our religion. Saint Aquinas wrote this: God's purpose in creation was the communication of his own goodness, in which his creatures participate by reason of their existence and in measure of it. Now, only, I think, the only, by the most heavy-handed and sensitive treatment, can the Bible and other relevant material be used to support the view that the natural world is ours to do anything we want it with. What place and what value the animals and the rest of created order have is bound up in the question, what value do we have and why? Sandmeyer, a philosopher, wrote that nothing comparable to modern exploitation of nature was known in biblical times. Of course, you can say, well, they didn't have the technology to do it, to exploit to that extent. But the ecological ills, which are sometimes blamed on the Judeo-Christian influence, especially the command, have dominion and subdue it, are not at all necessary outgrowth of that statement. Certainly, Israelite tradition did not evidence them. In fact, a case can be made quite to the contrary, and I'd like now we'll set sort of the record straight. And what Dr. Rinbach has done is to look at what he calls some of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, as well as fables and some of the writings, post-rabbinical writings. And we'll have Proverbs 6:6. Somebody read Proverbs 6:6.
Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise.
Yeah, so in other words, he's teaching via the animals some desirable aspects. And another one, Malachi 4:2, I guess it is. Somebody got that?
But for you who fear my name, the Sun of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. You shall go forth leaping like calves from the stall.
Yeah, and you see in a lot, and we'll see some more now, about under the shadow of my wing, as a secure place, referring to an animal in many places. And then like calves, some of you I know on farms, when you turn out a calf in the spring after it's been in the barn for a while, it doesn't even see fences, but boy, it sure has a time, you know, it jumps into the air, and it's, they've obviously seen that, and the joy of this release is very obvious. And then we'll turn to Matthew 6:26. Somebody got that?
Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. And you not, are you not of more faith? of more value than they.
Right. That's my justification to be a birder or a bird watcher, you see. It says, look at the birds. It's Jesus' command, you look at the birds. So that's why I'm always carrying around something to look at the birds with. And there are, that we depend then upon God, both the birds and we. And then in parenting, we look at the two of the Psalms there. Might as well read them both.
Probably. Shadow of thy wings.
Yeah. There again, this protection of the animal wings. And then in another one, what is 29:6 say?
He makes Lebanon to skip like a calf from Syrian, like a young wild ox.
Yeah. And again, that happiness of it all. And then in Matthew 23:37, somebody got that?
Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those who are sent to you. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings,
yeah. And
you would not.
Yeah, it's like a hen gathering her chicks, this protection. Again, this analogy of the animals. Deuteronomy 22:6.
If you chance to come upon a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting upon the young or upon the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young.
Yeah. Now that's pretty clear, isn't it? That we show kindness and sensitivity to all animals, and also. Now, you hold on to Deuteronomy there, because I'm going to have you read the 25:4 in a minute after we read Exodus 23:10. Somebody got Exodus 23:10?
For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor and the people may eat, and that what they leave the wild beasts may eat.
Yep.
You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard.
Yeah. In other words, but also, we have to add that also the Sabbath, every week, the seventh day, was a day of rest not only for people, but for animals. Probably of no organized religion. That's unique for an organized religion, that they respect the Sabbath the same for their animals as the people. And then if you go back now, Karen, to Deuteronomy 25:4, I think it is. No, yeah, 25:4.
You shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain.
That's right. It has a right to some of this, you see. It's interesting in post-rabbinical writings that they have a special phrase that stood for cruelty to anything that possesses life. And I think that's probably where some of Schweitzer got his. And in fact, it was considered a crime. If you take any life. And this extended, incidentally, to how they killed for slaughter, and I'll have something to say about that. But I have down here Proverbs. One of my favorite verses is in Proverbs. It says, "A righteous man hath regard for his beast," and it's the one I most often bring up. Now, on the post-biblical literature of the rabbis, it's marked by numerous legislations designed to ensure kindness to animals and to prevent them from being mistreated. They recognized that animal slaughter was necessary for society, but they took elaborate precautions to minimize the pain involved. In fact, in the Middle Ages, a fellow named Maimonides, he got a list of 70 prescriptions which constituted unskillful and therefore unacceptable slaughter. In other words, they tried to figure out the best way to do it. Incidentally, that's under attack now again, as to what really is kosher killing, and is it is it the best way to go? There's a big argument now going on in this. It's interesting to know that in early times, the Jews were not known to kill animals for sport. None of this is kind of interesting. And the only interruption to a Jewish meal in early times was that if you hadn't fed your beast. A man is forbidden to eat anything until he has fed his beast, which is pretty strong language. And rabbinical literature is full of stories that center on well-known biblical figures. I'll illustrate a few of these. If men made a sea voyage and take cattle with them, should a storm arise, they jettison the animals to save mankind, because people do not love animals as much as they love human beings. Not so is God's love. Just as he is merciful to man, so is he merciful to beasts. And from rabbinic anthology, the falling of rain is greater than the giving of the law. For the giving of the law was a joy only to Israel, while the falling of rain is rejoicing, is a rejoicing for all the world, including the cattle and the wild beasts and the birds. And while Moses was feeding the sheep of his father-in-law in the wilderness, a young kid ran away. Moses followed it until it reached a ravine where it found a well to drink from. And when Moses reached it, he said, "I did not know that you ran away because you were thirsty. Now you must be weary." And he carried the kid back. And then God said, "Because thou hast shown pity in leading back one of my flock belonging to man, thou shalt lead my flock Israel." In fact, there is some evidence to indicate that both Moses and David were selected for their leadership roles because of their concern for animals. And in the biblical book of Jonah, the prophet wanted God to destroy the inhabitants of Nineveh. He was really wicked with them, and he wanted to call down fire and destroy them. And this was countered by an expression of mercy by God towards, and I'm going to have you read Jonah 4:11. It's a very, very important statement there.
"And should not I pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle?"
That's right. He could have stopped there, but you see, it's also much cattle. And you see, the rainbow covenant that God made with his people wasn't only with people, was it? It was with all creatures, you see. Made it with all creatures. Now, let's see, we're down to Jonah. Ah, we got to have Samuel. That's a very telling one. 2 Samuel 12, 2 and 3. It's a very interesting thing. You know, you say, is there any indication of real pets, of having pets in the Old Testament? And that's why I want you to read this.
"The rich man had many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel, and drink from his cup, and lie in his bosom. And it was like a daughter to him."
Yeah. How does that grab you? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people forget that. What he's doing, he's given David a lesson. But those words would indicate that they were not only kindly treated, they were pets. Now we have a couple of beautiful statements here that we want to read. Somebody find Song of Solomon 2, 11 and 12, while somebody else is finding Isaiah 11, 6 and 7. It would suggest that this idyllic scene may be an acknowledgement by this prophet to say, you know, maybe the way things are isn't the way it probably should be in the human-animal interaction. And there's a promise that maybe better things to come. Now, I want to turn to one of my favorite preachers in my generation is Helmut Tillicke, who has been here at the village. He's probably one of the better known pastors in Germany. He's written some very good books. One most made the most impression on me was The Waiting Father. And he is very interested in animals. He has he had a dog named Axel. And he in a book, Being a Christian When the Chips Are Down, in 1981, he wrote as follows. Paul once used the enigmatic phrase groaning, the groaning of the creation in Romans, and indicated that it too cried out for redemption. This is not the place to go into what is meant by that phrase. It involves the ultimate mysteries. I will only describe how the phrase took on meaning for me personally. Once when I was a young man, before I concerned myself with the theological dimensions of that obscure phrase, I asked an elderly servant of God how he made sense out of it. He simply said, "Look a dog in the eye, and then you will know." I've been looking at my wife's dog in the eye quite a bit and wondered about it myself. Now, I don't believe for a minute that he gave me an adequate explanation of that phrase. But since that time, I have never ceased to ponder what he said. When I look at a dog and he looks at me, those words come back again and again. And although one must guard against sentimentality and reading too much into the situation, I nevertheless cannot shake the feeling that a real dialogue with the creation takes place. And that is the way it sounds. And then he went on to say this, "My little canine friend, you are just one particular part of creation. The two of us, in contrast to innumerable fellow creatures of yours, have been brought together in a remarkable way and live with one another. If something bad would happen to you, I would be very upset. And I know that if something would happen to me, that your canine heart would be affected. You notice at once if something is bothering me. And if I am happy, then you make the most droll attempts to show me that you rejoice with me. Sometimes the riddle of creation gazes at me from your eyes so powerfully, so terribly, that it penetrates me through and through. I imagine that you suffer under the burden of not being able to express yourself and tell me what you know. Of course, you can be very expressive with your many bodily motions, with your tail wagging, even with your little paws, but speaking is just out of the question. Sometimes you let me know that I do not understand. There is a very deep gulf between us that neither of us can cross. And precisely because you are such a unique part of creation, because you have bound up your canine destiny to me, a human being, this limitation becomes particularly painful. Our lives are more fully linked than I can say or you can bark. You are a dumb creature, and maybe you are thinking, my master is a noseless creature." But this is how he views this. Now, I should say that dogs did not come out very well in the Judeo-Christian tradition. They were pariah dogs that was often garbage collectors. But you also have to realize that rabies was one of the diseases of the time. And if you've ever seen anybody bitten by a dog, a rabid dog, and then die from it, that makes a very deep impression upon you. And that's why even today, in many parts of Africa, for example, and other places, that the dogs are feared and not very highly regarded. There are some exceptions to this. I mentioned some last night in Egypt. Certainly the Zoroastrians tend to worship them and regard them highly. But in the Bible, it was usually a term of derision. Dogs. In expressing their contempt for them. And I've talked to quite a few people who were raised in the Jewish tradition, even my contemporaries, who had a very poor regard for dogs. Like one was a very famous professor, he was in our faculty for a while, and he married a lady who had an Irish setter. And more or less, if you're going to marry me, love my dog. Now he did learn to love his dog. And he, when he was raised, boy, they were the only recollection he had of dogs were ones that chased him in Brooklyn. I mean, they were a terror, running pack. But he really went ape over his dog, lets it get away with too much. But he really fell in love with it, and as a sociologist internationally recognized, he saw the great benefits of what I talked about last night, about the importance of human-animal interaction. So that's most of what I wanted to talk about today.
What about places where animals are used as sacrifice all through the Old Testament?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And where it actually talks about eating flesh, and you shall eat flesh, and all that I've created for you.
And that doesn't sit well with a vegetarian. The Jews addressed this on the basis that, as carnivores, I suppose, in their tradition, they probably may have difficulty making it and surviving without that protein in early days, because you probably weren't advanced, and I want some of you to challenge this. We weren't raising a lot of soybeans. We might have got by on some. They probably had lentils early on. They didn't have B12 to supplement their ration, so they would not have been able to have reproduction. So it may have been considered at that time a necessity for survival. As to the, I have a hard time with the sacrifice of animals. I think they tried to do it in a humane way. It had a great significance as far as the tradition, to carrying on their tradition of their religion. And if, like we learned yesterday, if you're going to carry on a tradition and a liturgy, you memorize it, and as a rock and a fortress and a stability for a religion. Are there some other views on this? We should have a theologian here to give the exposé on this. How do you feel about it?
Well, I have kind of mixed feelings about it. I grew up in a rural area where my parents butchered animals. They raised and butchered animals and sold animals for slaughter, and continue to eat meat and produce beef. I do eat meat, not a lot, because for other kind of environmental reasons and a lot of other kind of reasons, but I always wonder about it, you know, where, you know, there are all these passages where it talks about reverence for life, and yet there's also ones where it clearly said, you know, anything that I have created is good for you to consume, and, you know.
Yes, this question, for the purposes of tape ministry, relates to the sacrifice of animals and the eating of flesh. And there have been many philosophical discussions on this. And in my Reverence for Life class, one of the subjects we take up is vegetarianism. And we may, if there's enough interest, next week we may do this. And there are several philosophical reasons to be vegetarians. And we have seen an upsurge in this. Back in 500, B.C. or so, some of the leading people, such as Plutarch and many of the other philosophers, were vegetarians for ethical reasons. Of course, they didn't probably have a real humane slaughter at that time. Some of them were pretty crude. But for quite a few hundreds of years, some of the leading people were vegetarians. And then it sort of fell away for at least 1,000 years or so, or more, 1,500 perhaps. It is only in the last few decades that we've seen an increase in vegetarianism. Now, this reasons for this, in summary, is that some of them are ethical. Some of them say that, well, the way they kill the animals, we don't like that. The way they battery produce their pigs and their chickens is not acceptable. There are others who say we feel that on the basis of, for nutritional reasons, we've been eating too much red meat. So that we'll eat chicken, which turns out that might have more fat than some beef. There is also some beef raised without high grain input or a large grain input. So there's a lot of ignorance that prevails in this. There is some indication with high intake of animal fats, depending on the rest of your nutrition, that the incidence of heart disease and colonic cancer is increased. Now, some of the information that is cited on that are studies on Seventh-day Adventists who are vegetarians. A lot of them are vegetarians. But there's a conflicting or a confusing part of that is that Seventh-day Adventists don't smoke or drink either. So you need another control because we know that contributes also to heart disease and cancer. I don't think it's been published yet, but the Loma Linda, the Seventh-day Adventist school, did a study on this in California. Usually when I discuss this, I usually try to have some vegetarians present. And when I was at the University of Georgia discussing this, we had one girl in the class who was a first-year veterinary student who had become, hadn't balanced her diet. When you take a vegetarian diet, you got to watch what you're eating. If you can get into trouble. Well, pernicious anemia. She came out with pernicious anemia. But she recovered. Another girl did it because she went into vegetarianism pretty much because she was, her folks, her mother and her uncles all got colonic cancer. But they had sausage and meat every morning. They had meat for lunch and meat for supper, and with quite a bit of fat. And probably another hazard here from another standpoint is overheating, because that probably converts to carcinogens. And she ended up, so she, because they all end up with colonic cancer, she wasn't going to take that chance. Yes?
I was going to say, another thing they're doing is that's really bad for the human digestive system is they're shooting the cattle with the female hormone. And it's what they're feeding. It's not a totally natural diet. They're doing this to produce more cattle in a shorter period of time. It's out of
the yeah, it contributes to the growth rate. They're coming down pretty hard on residuals now, and there are test systems mm-hmm. to check so that this is, I don't think, as big a problem now. You may address this from your ranching standpoint. What are the restrictions on this now in your area, do you know?
I'm not sure, yeah. But I know that there are ads for, I think it's called Syntex or something like that, that's supposed to be a natural substance.
Yeah.
I know, as opposed to some that aren't.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, but I've been reading the ads that, you know, say it's natural.
Yeah.
But we do not do that.
A lot of people don't.
I think there's a problem with antibiotics too. Animals being given lots of antibiotics.
Yeah, the problem with antibiotics is that one of the suggested problems is that if you you can give antibiotics to an animal, and you can have a healthier animal probably and have a better growth rate. It seems to act as a stimulant in a ruminant. But the downside of it is that you may have some introduction organisms that become resistant to that antibiotic, and then if you then need it to go, it isn't going to get that organism, you see, because organisms are very adaptable. I think that's one of the principal things raised by the Food and Drug Administration.
Out of concern for animals too, what do you think about like experimental psychology, where animals are used and there's a controversy now whether they're as respectful and kind to the animal as they should be.
There is no issue in during my generation, as far as the federal government goes, as far as the number of letters raising an issue that exceeds that having to do with animals and experimentation, as far as letters arriving in Washington. There are many people who are on this side and said that there should be no utilization of any animals in any research. There are those people over here who say that we can do any kind of research we want on animals, because after all, we have dominion over our, and we, so we can treat them like laboratory equipment. And I'm somewhere in here. Many of you, and I know I, would not be alive today had not some animal experiments been run.
Leo, for the sake of Take Ministry, they could not see you pointing in the middle.
Oh, that's a good point. I was describing here, and Dr. Collins pointed out very appropriately that there are people who are on one side or the other of the issue, and I'm somewhere in between both of these issues, because I feel that there are certain experiments that should not be done. There are some experiments that need to be done. I think before any experiment, we must ask, is this trip necessary? And are the animals properly treated? As Schweitzer would say, that take every concern that any pain they might cause is relieved. But there's another question you have to ask, and that is, what will it cost if you don't do the experiment? And I have, sometimes when I give the talk on this, and maybe we should do it next week, is I have a picture of a manufacturing plant for iron lungs. Now, we could have gone on, instead of trying to get a vaccine for polio, we could have gone on and built bigger and better iron lungs to take care of these people who were paralyzed, to keep them alive for the rest of their life in an iron lung. But we chose another route. We chose to utilize a number of animals in experimentation to develop a vaccine. Now here's a conflicting or a very complicating issue is that if one examines all of the research that went into developing the polio vaccine, because I am of an age that when I grew up, boy, we were scared of this. There were certain places we wouldn't go swimming because, you know, people would get polio there. And some of my friends died. And people still are suffering today from it. Probably about half of the experiments that went in to develop the polio vaccine were probably, the object of the experiment was not to develop a polio vaccine. It was to get the basic information on immunology and to develop a vaccine, you see. So that's the complicating thing that a lot of people don't understand. And today, we are probably saving, as a result of the polio vaccine, $3 billion a year. It can hopefully be used for something else to help people. But even more important, it's relieving the suffering of a lot of people and the parents of a lot of people. Because I saw this firsthand, and it's heart-rending, you see. So I feel that the trip was worth it. By the same token, you can look at the heart disease thing. We have, in the last 20 years, had a remarkable decrease in deaths due to heart attack. There was two fellows. One of them I met, who was at the University of California when I was there. And he and a friend examined all the literature they could find that has contributed to this remarkable reduction in incidence of heart disease that has occurred. And they figured about over 60% of the studies that they felt contributed to this were of a basic nature with not the control of heart disease in mind. And you see, that makes again the point of this. And much of the research, like this whole thing on AIDS, one of my former students was the co-discoverer of the virus from AIDS. Now, how did he get onto this? Well, see, he worked with us on feline leukemia virus. And one of my associates discovered the feline sarcoma virus. But these were cat viruses of the same family. And we knew that there were certain viruses that caused a depression in immunological competence, you see? And with that background, you see, he could do it. And that basic knowledge, if we didn't have it, I'm not real. I can't be real optimistic for an early fix on this, but it's hard to predict on this. But this same fellow told me that 4 years ago, we're in very deep trouble because of this virus. And we are. And most people don't realize the full significance of it yet. It's a scourge. It's a real scourge. And the victims, and the children, and the hemophiliacs, and the people that have had blood transfusions. The whole blood transfusion issue is you almost now, you're almost better off not having a transfusion. I mean, it's gotten to that, you see. My wife just had an operation and we did not go to blood transfusion.